Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. With Tax Day fast approaching, tens of millions of Americans are trying to meet the April 18th deadline by sifting through a very complicated tax code. Many people rely on tax software and tax accountants to ease the pain. According to the IRS, preparing a 1040 form takes the average taxpayer 8 hours. In 2015, Americans spent almost 6 billion hours filling out their forms and more than $12 billion on tax software. This is not the case in other countries. Today's guest, T.R. Reid, traveled to 21 countries to find out how the U.S. tax code compares. And when he told economists that Americans think their taxes are too high, they laughed. Of the 35 richest countries, the United States ranks 33rd in the total tax burden, which greatly affects social services and our society's overall well-being. U.S. billionaires pay relatively little tax. In fact, some pay no tax at all. France, Norway, and Switzerland all have wealth taxes designed to reduce income inequality. T.R. Reid writes that the U.S. tax code is a total write-off. Overstuffed with loopholes and special interest provisions, it really works for no one except lawyers, accountants, the wealthy, and corporations. So what would a fair and just tax system actually look like? T.R. Reid joins us today, and he's the author of his new book, which is called A Fine Mess, A Global Quest for a Simpler, Fair, and More Efficient Tax System. T.R. is a commentator for National Public Radio, a foreign correspondent for The Washington Post, and he'll be speaking at the Commonwealth Club today at noon, 555 Post Street, and he'll be on the PBS NewsHour tonight. And T.R. joins me in studio. Hi, T.R. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. It's great to be on your air. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's great to have you, and thanks for writing this book, because there are so many myths about the U.S. tax system. Why did you decide to travel to 21 countries to compare our tax code to others?
I was a foreign correspondent for the Washington Post. I did that because I like the Washington Post. But if you work in the newsroom, your boss is never more than 10 feet away. You know, they can come down and read over your shoulder. I never liked that. So I was thinking, God, I like the job. I'd like to get a little further than 10 feet from the boss. So I moved 10,000 miles away. I became a foreign correspondent. That really worked. They never bugged me. And when you're overseas, what are you going to write about? Some people like kind of quaint foreigner stories. You know, they eat squid for breakfast kind of thing. I never liked that. So I thought I'd take a look at what other countries do that works and what they do that we should never do. So this is called comparative policy analysis. And the basic idea is pretty simple. If your college or your company or your country has a problem, well, one way to solve it is see what some other country did to solve it. And that's what I did. So I looked at all these tax codes because we are blessed with the most complicated tax code on the planet. It's an unfair tax code. It's inefficient. It's really not working. And it turns out a lot of other rich democracies have done a much better job.
So many things struck me about your book, but one thing especially, when you spoke with economists in other countries and you said that Americans think they pay their taxes are just too high, they actually laughed when you said that.
Yeah, nobody else would say that. Now, our president, Donald Trump, said many times during the campaign, America is the highest taxed country in the world. This turns out to be an alternative fact, Rose. As a matter of fact, as you said, in the standard ranking, and to get that tax burden measure, here's what you do. You add up all the local, state, and federal taxes in the whole country and take that total as a percentage of gross domestic product of total wealth. By that measure, the United States ranks right at the bottom of the richest countries. We pay less in income tax and Social Security tax and sales tax and gas tax and tobacco tax. Trump has a point in a couple of areas. Our corporate income tax rate is higher than almost any country. France is higher because they're great at gouging people, but it's too high. And the president has a point. It's unfair. It's an unfair disadvantage for American corporations. And guess what? When you set the rate high, it's 35%, they don't pay. Mm. They pay accountants and lawyers to figure out how they conduct the tax. And I found that all over the world. When you set the rate really high, France had a top rate of 75%. Guess what? Rich people move to Belgium. Hmm. They flee the tax. So there's a limit to how much you can gouge people before they just stop paying.
And we'll talk about corporate tax in a minute, but let's stick with this fact that you found about of the U.S. ranking 33 in total tax burden when you look at the 35 richest countries. Can you again elaborate on that? Because I'm sure a lot of people are surprised by this statistic.
Yeah, Americans think we pay too much. Relative to the other countries like us, advanced, free market, high-tech democracies, we're one nation undertaxed, as they say. And the reason is, I think the reason for it is basic philosophical position. Europeans like government. In East Asia, the Japanese and the South Koreans, they basically like government. Americans have always felt, since we overthrew the tyrant George III and started our own country, we want to keep away from government. We want to limit government. And therefore, we don't pay as much for government. We pay less in taxes, and we get less government. Government spends less of our wealth than in other rich countries. And a lot of the stuff that people do through government in other countries, we do through charity. And as a matter of fact, Americans give more to private charity than anybody else.
How do you think Americans' opinions about taxes have really changed over the decades? And when I started reading your book, I was thinking about Grover Norquist, who basically threatens politicians and says, if you don't sign this no tax pledge, we're going to run someone against you and give them a lot of money. And so what do you think about that? How do you think opinions about taxes have changed over the decades, and why?
Well, as American politics have turned somewhat to the right, the anti-tax movement has grown. It used to be that people willingly paid their taxes. They thought there was a contract. I mean, as I said to Grover Norquist, you know, he hates government. He doesn't want to pay any tax. So build your own highway from your house to your office. He goes out on the government street every day. He has the Washington, D.C. Fire Department put out the fire at his house. He expects those services. And if you want government services, you have to pay for them. That's pretty basic. So it used to be in the 1950s, the top income tax rate in the United States was 90% for the richest people, and they paid it. Today it's 39.6%, and they all complain. In fact, Americans, even though we pay less, we complain more about taxes than anybody else.
And what did you find overseas when you looked at how taxes are actually spent?
Well, governments do more in other countries. In Western Europe, higher education is free all the way through graduate school. When we lived in England, we had two kids still under the age of 18, and every month I got a check for each kid for about $100. That's called child benefit. Mm. So I'm thinking, whoa, man, that's the European welfare state right there. They pay you just to have kids. Would Americans ever do that? Well, as a matter of fact, yes, we do. I came home, filled out my tax return, and I get an exemption of $4,000 for each of my kids. Comes out to about the same as that welfare check I got from the British government every month. But, of course, it's not welfare in the United States because it's a tax cut.
You also mention in your book that gas taxes are incredibly high in other countries, in some cases $6 a gallon. When people go to Europe, they're shocked to see how much people pay for gas. But you point out that in many of these countries, they have incredible public transportation.
Yes, exactly right. So in Japan, a gallon of gas costs about $8.
Wow.
People expect that, and they have fabulous trains. The bullet trains are the best trains in the world, and people expect them to be good. Nobody would put up with the kind of railroads we have. I was on BART yesterday. It's so loud, you know, and it stops. In other countries, they wouldn't put up with that. And, of course, because their gas tax is so high, German and French and Japanese and Korean car makers have produced these very efficient, fuel-efficient cars and hybrids. And this is another instance where taxation drives innovation.
And Trump is getting rid of the fuel efficiency standards that were passed under the Obama administration.
Yeah, which is fine as long as gasoline is only $2.50 a gallon. If it goes back up to $5 a gallon, it's not going to look like such a smart idea. People are going to buy German and Japanese cars again.
Today we're joined by T.R. Reid. He traveled to 21 countries to compare the U.S. tax code to others, and he wrote about it in his new book, A Fine Mess, A Global Quest for a Simpler, Fairer, and More Efficient Tax System. And if you have any questions or comments about our tax system, we'd love to hear from you. What do you think about this statistic? When you look at 35 of the richest countries, the United States ranks 33rd in total tax burden. There's so many interesting facts in this book. For example, Dutch taxpayers need only 15 minutes on average to file their taxes. In the UK and Japan, the average is just 5 minutes. TR also reports that the IRS could make things very simple for Americans so that tax day would be just another sunny spring day. But when simplification is proposed in Congress, H&R Block and the tax software companies lobby against it. You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. This was the other thing that surprised me. You write that you don't see H&R Blocks in other countries.
Yeah, you can walk down the street in London, Lima, Amsterdam, Tokyo. You don't see any of those tax preparation companies. They don't need that industry. And the reason is, in America, we have put the heavy burden on the taxpayer. The IRS says an average family of four at a median income about $56,000 spends about 12 hours a year gathering the data and filling the forms and spends $260. You have to pay money just to pay the money you owe the government. Nobody else would put up with that. In other countries, it takes 10, 15 minutes and it's free. In Japan, get this, the tax agency sends you a postcard in early March. It says, we think you earned this much, we withheld this much, we owe you a refund of this much, we'll put it in your bank account on April 1st. Or, you owe us some more, we'll take it out of your bank on April 1st. It takes 1 minute. You read the postcard. If it looks right, you're done. No return. Wow. 85% of people don't. If you don't like the number, then you have to go into the tax office and complain.
How did the tax code in the United States become so complex? You write that every 32 years, the tax code becomes complex and cumbersome. The only way to fix it is to scratch the whole thing and start over again. And this was done in 1922, 1954, and 1986. And this is big news. I was surprised this didn't get more attention during election season. 2018 marks another 32 years since the last big reform.
Yeah, that's right. I think we're going to fix our tax code by 2018. And I say that because history repeats itself, and there's a reason. What happens is they first set up the tax, the federal income tax in 1913. It was incredibly popular, Rose. Americans loved it because hardly anybody paid it. It was aimed only at the Roosevelts and the Astors and the Vanderbilts. And then gradually it expanded to pay for World War I, to get us out of the recession and things. And as the taxes get higher, the lobbyists come in and everybody puts in their favorite exemption or credit or deduction. And the thing gets so complicated, nobody can handle it. 32 years after 1922, we rewrote the tax code in 54. It was a clean, simple code. Guess what? Over 32 years, more stuff creeped in. And in 86, we rewrote the code. The time has come. It's been 31 years, so we really need the IRS code today is 73,000 pages. And I said to the commissioner of the IRS, has anybody in your agency read the whole thing? He laughed at me. Of course not. So the time has come to sweep it clean. If we got rid of all those giveaways and deductions and credits, then we could reduce the rate sharply, and then it wouldn't be in your interest to hire a lawyer. You'd just pay the tax. It'd be cheaper.
As you mentioned, Donald Trump did not speak truthfully when he said that the U.S. has the highest tax rate in the world. If you think that the tax code might be written next year, what do you expect from this administration?
Well, there are two ways to do it. The predictable way, I hate to say, would be they cut rates without raising the revenue, and that just adds to the deficit, and they throw in more giveaways for favored industries or for wealthy taxpayers. That's the way they generally do it. But as I say, every three decades, they throw out everything and start over. So what I say is there are hundreds of exemptions and credits in our tax code. I mean, we give you a tax break for taking a night school course, growing sugarcane, replanting a forest, insulating the attic, paying off your mortgage, destroying old farm equipment, commuting to work by bicycle. There are just hundreds of them in there, and the thing to do is get them all out, and then you can reduce the rate sharply. And people will complain and say, oh, my God, don't take away my deduction. I like that. But if you get rid of all of them and reduce the rates, that's the carrot and stick thing. You can say, well, now the code is much simpler. It won't take you 20 hours, and you'll pay a lower rate. So this has worked three times in American history. It would work again if Congress and the president want to do it.
Cutting taxes has been a top priority for Republicans across the board under the George W. Bush administration. We had major tax cuts for the wealthy, and they often say that this is going to stimulate the economy and create jobs. But here we are after that administration with massive inequality, poverty. A lot of people cannot find decent jobs. According to David K. Johnston, the Bush tax cuts, which were extended under Obama, have cost Americans about $6.6 trillion. What did you find doing your research about tax cuts?
Yeah, you know, the people who favor tax cuts have this wonderful idea, and they call it dynamic scoring. And that says if we just cut the tax rate, then people will go out and do more work and more investment, and it'll actually make a bigger economy and more revenue will come in. In other words, you pay less and you get more. It doesn't work. It's too bad. It's a wonderful idea. If only we could get something for nothing, it would be sweet. It's very hard to find a time in history when it worked. And, of course, the Bush tax cuts were the two biggest tax cuts in American history in 2001-2003. Revenue dropped sharply. And then, of course, 4 years later, we had the biggest recession in 75 years. So it didn't work. Contrast that to the 1990s. Two presidents, the first Bush and Clinton, raised taxes, and the 1990s were the biggest economic boom in 50 years. So I wish it were true that you could cut taxes and it would cause a big revenue boom. It just hasn't worked, unfortunately.
T.R. Reid is author of A Fine Mess, A Global Quest for a Simpler, Fairer, and More Efficient Tax System. And he traveled to 21 countries to compare the U.S. tax code to others. He'll be speaking at the Commonwealth Club today at noon, 555 Post Street. And you can find more information at yourcallradio.org. Let's hear from Lisa in San Francisco. Hi, Lisa. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you very much for covering such an important topic. I wanted to mention that these major tax cuts, I mean, we oftentimes during this time, we rely on the individual tax issue without looking at the big picture, the fact that these major corporations and banks have, and unfortunately fossil fuel companies get massive tax subsidies and they literally do not pay their fair share of taxes. I'd also like to say that, and here is a plug-in, a conference that's going to be done this Saturday by Labor Rising Against Trump, which is against the privatization of education, because those are the consequences of having this kind of system, economic system, where our education, our public education, is directly being affected, and that affects all of society and our youth and our future. And it's going to be at Saturday, April 15th at 155 Duinell in UC Berkeley, and it's sponsored by Labor Rising Against Trump. And it's an emergency education conference for California.
All right. Thank you so much. We'll put a link at our website, Your Call Radio. Since Lisa brought up corporations, you have a whole section in your book, TR, about corporations. And you write that according to the General Accounting Office, between 1998 and 2005, 55% of all large U.S.-controlled corporations reported no federal tax liability in at least 1 year. You have a bunch of examples in here. Let's talk about Apple Computer.
Yeah, Apple is a highly innovative company. It's a big American success story. And they have very skillfully moved a lot of their profit overseas. So Apple relies, its biggest assets are its design, its intellectual property. And they gave the rights to that to Apple subsidiaries overseas, mainly in Ireland. And if you do that, then a lot of the profit is shifted to Ireland. And I think they were paying a tax at a rate of 2% in Ireland.
Yep.
Now, I need to say that Tim Cook, the chairman of Apple, when he was challenged on this, he said, no, we pay tons of tax, and they do. They pay a lot of American tax, But they pay a lot less than you would think they would under the tax code because they've shifted so much overseas. And Tim Cook said, well, that's because the rate is too high. And, you know, he's right. Our 35% tax rate is higher than almost any other country. That's the rate on corporate income. And as I said, when you do that, it's in their interest, it's in their financial interest to find a way to move the money. The Caterpillar Corporation, you know, they make those big iconic yellow tractors and earth movers. They paid Price Waterhouse $55 million to design a system for them to move a lot of their profit to Switzerland. Well, $55 million is a lot of money. It saved them $8 billion in federal tax.
Wow.
So if we cut the federal tax rate and got rid of a whole bunch of loopholes in there for corporations, they wouldn't have an interest in doing that. It'd be easier for them just to pay the tax they owe.
You report that Google created a company called Google Bermuda Unlimited based in Hamilton, Bermuda. Google's Bermuda subsidiary is the official corporate owner of a separate subsidiary called Google Ireland Holdings. When I was reading about some of these systems, I couldn't even keep track.
No, it's very hard to keep track. Google has a subsidiary of a subsidiary of a subsidiary. And that was assigned all the profits from all Google's earnings in Europe and Africa so that the money didn't come home to America and therefore it wasn't taxed at American tax rates. It's bizarre what the companies do, but and you know, it's really not excusable, but it's understandable because our rate is higher than they would pay in other countries.
Based on what you learned overseas, what changes to the corporate tax code would you like to see?
I think the corporations and President Trump are right when they say our tax rate is too high, that 35% rate is too high. Now, no company really pays it. In fact, if any company ever actually paid 35% in tax, they'd fire the chief financial officer the next morning. But still, even the effective rate, the amount they actually pay is higher than companies in other countries do. So we should reduce the rate, and to keep the revenue coming in, we ought to get rid of all these. There are hundreds and hundreds of exemptions and deductions for just one company that have been written into the tax code. Their lobbyist comes in. They veil it. They don't say the name of the company. There are a couple of provisions in there that say, here's a tax break for any company that was incorporated in Delaware on October 16th, 1913. Well, that would be General Motors, but they never say that. And then the sponsor of this exclusion says this is very important for the common good. Well, if it were true, we might put the name on. The fact that they're hiding it tells you that they know, too, this is a scam.
When I read this statistic in your book, I wondered why it doesn't get more attention, especially at a time when our social services are so strapped. You work with the homeless in Colorado, and we'll talk about that later in the show. But you look at our infrastructure, our state of education. You write that in the 1960s, the corporate tax brought in about 33% of tax revenues, okay, 33%. Today, the same tax provides less than 9% of revenues. So corporate taxes went from 33% down to 9%, which means that we individuals have to pick up the slack. The individual income tax and Social Security tax constituted about 50% of all federal tax revenues in the 60s, and now that is 80%. This is a huge shift.
Yeah, they've shifted the burden from corporations to individuals. It's, other countries have not done this. In other countries, corporations pay about a third of all the revenue, but American corporations are so skillful, A, at getting Congress to change the code and then using the exemptions that they've written into the code, that they pay much less. And as I say, part of the reason is because our rate is higher. I think if we got the rate down, they'd have less interest in doing that. And then the other thing is we ought to just get rid of hundreds and hundreds of exemptions that are in there for specific industries.
I'm guessing that most Americans don't know about this. Why doesn't it get more attention? Why can't we start a dialogue about whether this is the kind of country we want to live in?
Yeah, it's a good question. So the fact is, in the United States, unlike any other democracy, money is determined to be an item of free speech. Our Supreme Court has said giving money to a politician is protected by our free speech protection. No other country has said that. And the result is money really talks in the U.S. Congress. And if you make contributions, you get into the senator's office, and you propose this fairly obscure provision for a company incorporated in Delaware in 1913, and it turns out to be a big break for a specific company. That's why I say let's get rid of them. Let's get rid of the corporate ones, and the giveaways to individuals are pretty stunning, too.
T.R. Reid is author of A Fine Mess, A Global Quest for a Simpler, Fairer, and More Efficient Tax System. He traveled to 21 countries to compare our tax code to others and found a lot of differences. If you look at the 35 richest countries in the world, the United States ranks 33rd in total tax burden. TR will be speaking about his findings at the Commonwealth Club today at noon, 555 Post Street here in San Francisco. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this.
This is Your Call on KALW Local Public Radio. If you have a perspective you haven't heard in today's discussion or a question that you feel needs to be answered, please join the conversation by calling 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK, toll free. You can also send an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org or post a comment or question at the show's website, yourcallradio.org. You can also tweet us at Your Call Radio. Coming up at 11, new to the KLW lineup, Monday through Thursday at 11, it's On Point from WBUR in Boston. Stay with us.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, it's our media roundtable, and we will be discussing U.S.-Russia climate change policies. Like Donald Trump, Vladimir Putin denies that humans cause climate change. He also says that the melting Arctic ice will benefit Russia's economy. We'll also talk about the latest SF Public Press report on sea level rise and waterfront developments in San Francisco. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we are joined by T.R. Reid. His latest book is called A Fine Mess, A Global Quest for a Simpler, Fairer, and More Efficient Tax System. T.R. is also author of The Healing of America. In many ways, these books are kind of connected because he also traveled the world to look at the U.S. healthcare system compared to others. This one is about the tax system. And TR will be speaking at the Commonwealth Club at noon today, 555 Post Street in San Francisco. And if you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Let's hear from Mark in San Francisco. Hi, Mark. Welcome to the show. Oh, Mark is gone. We have a few more. Actually, we've got a couple of emails. We had one person send us an email before the show saying, asking a question about the 35 richest countries and the U.S. coming up 33rd.
Yeah.
He says, if you look at combined taxes, that's not lower than many countries. And that doesn't include the fees that are really taxes because no politician wants to be on record raising taxes. What do you think?
I don't buy that. We have replaced taxes with fees you have to pay to enter the national park. But generally, government services in America are not fees. I mean, if I borrow a book at the San Francisco Public Library, they don't charge me, do they?
No.
And you don't charge. I was in a San Francisco park today. They don't charge you to walk in. So there are some fees. No, the statistic is right. It's prepared by the International Monetary Fund and the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, which is kind of the United Nations of rich countries. And here's what they do. You take all the federal, state, and local taxes in the whole country, total them up, and take them as a percentage of gross wealth. And by that measure, that's the standard measure. Everybody agrees on it, and everybody agrees that we're right down at the bottom. Mexico, Chile, and South Korea have slightly lower tax burdens than the U.S., but Rose, what do you think? Which countries do you think are the champion taxers of the world, the biggest taxers?
The biggest.
Yeah.
I'd say Denmark, Switzerland.
Yeah, Switzerland's in the middle, but yeah, Scandinavia, Denmark and Sweden, Belgium and France. Those are the four big taxers. And I think this is kind of interesting. One thing we know for sure, if you listen to American political debates, high taxes stifle economic growth, right?
Right.
Yeah.
And companies will leave.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. Except for some reason, Denmark, with more than twice our tax burden, has had higher growth rates than the United States almost every year for the last 50 years. So, so much for that theory.
What else strikes you about the differences between how Americans feel about paying taxes versus people in other countries? I recently met a well-off man who's from Canada, and he said that his entire healthcare bill, and he has the top healthcare in Canada, is about $3,000 a year.
Yeah, a year. Yeah.
And his tax rate is about 45%. And I said, well, how do you feel about paying that? And he said, well, when I get together with my friends, we don't like it, but we live in a society that we all have to pay into. And then when I've met people on trips in parts of Europe, they'd say, you know, I don't like paying these high taxes, but I went to law school for free. And anytime something happens, I never have to worry about a high hospital bill.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Nobody likes paying taxes. But there is a sense of the collective obligation that's stronger in other countries. America, what's our primary value? I'd say is individual freedom. Leave me alone. Let me build my own life. I think in Canada, if you asked any Canadian what's your highest value, they'd say equality, egalitarian. They want everybody to be treated the same. And if that means I pay a little more tax so that my neighbor gets health care, they're less inclined to complain about that than the U.S.
What other services are in high taxed countries that are not in the United States?
Well, in all of Europe, education is free from pre-K through graduate school. Britain has put on what we would consider a pretty small tuition fee for the richest families. It's about $6,000 a year to go to college.
Wow.
When we lived in Britain, two of my kids graduated from high school in Britain, and they could have gone to any college in Europe, you know, Hutteboer, Oxford, Cambridge, great schools for free. And they're Americans, and they said, we want to come home to America. It cost me an arm and a leg. It's fine. They got a good education. It's fine. In Europe, when you retire, you get a pension from the government that keeps you an income of about 90% of what you were making when you were working.
90%?
Yeah, about in France it's higher. They think that's an obligation, and they pay high taxes when they're working. And then when you retire, they take care of you, and your kids then pay the tax. And I always say to people, you know, if you're young and healthy, one thing you know for sure is it won't last. Mm. And so why not pay to help older, sicker people? Because you're going to be there someday, and you want others to help. And that sort of collectivist mindset is much stronger in Europe, in Japan, than in the United States, where we're into individual freedom and leave me alone.
And we have people in this country living off of a $900 SSI check per month, for example.
Isn't that amazing? Yeah, or less.
I mean,
there are people living, you walk down the street in San Francisco or Denver, there are people living on the street in the world's richest country. You know, in Europe, they would say, we ought to do something about that. And Americans are more inclined to say, hey, do it yourself. Take care of yourself. I took care of myself. And that's an important value. Individual freedom is an important value. But there also needs to be some sense that we're all in this together and we need to help our neighbors.
Let's hear from Mark in San Francisco. Hi, Mark. Welcome to the show.
Morning. I appreciate the perspectives on this important topic. I'm wondering what the international research has found about other taxes like estate tax, sales tax, capital gains tax, et cetera. Thank you.
Yeah. On the capital gains tax, that's the tax you pay when you sell a stock or you sell your home and make a profit. We're in the bottom half there, too. We're not as low as we are in overall taxes, but we pay less of those. Sales taxes, we pay less. Gas tax, we said we pay less. The estate tax is interesting. That's the tax that's paid by the lucky heir when her uncle leaves her $12 million. I personally like the estate tax because, by definition, it doesn't tax work. It only taxes lucky people who inherited some money. If you work for the money, you don't pay an estate tax. So I think it's a good tax. In America, it doesn't even kick in until you inherit $11 million. If you remember, a bunch of rich families hired a PR guy who named it the death tax. That was a killer name. Right. It's wrong. The dead guy doesn't pay. I mean, what if he didn't pay? We're going to put his corpse in jail? No, it's the lucky heir who pays. Bernie Sanders called it the Paris Hilton tax, you know, the lucky rich kids tax. Interestingly to me, many countries that we would consider to be big spending, lefty, socialist kind of countries have gotten rid of the estate tax. Hmm. Sweden,
why?
No estate tax. Well, the argument is the death tax argument. Enough is enough. Doggone it, I paid taxes for 60 years. Leave me alone when I'm dead, kind of thing. In Canada, when they took away the estate tax, they had a great slogan. No taxation without respiration. Don't you like that? And in Sweden, I said to this economist in Sweden, Sweden, you guys love taxes over here. Why would you get rid of the estate tax? And the economist said, was he kidding me? He said, you know, we tax them so high when they're alive, there's not much left to give. So,
well, thank you for calling in, Mark. Let's go next to Ruthann in El Cerrito. Hi, Ruthann.
Yeah, hi. I was wondering if you could explain to me why the rationale behind the threshold, if you're going to itemize deductions for charitable giving, is if it's over 2% of your adjusted gross income, whereas for medical deductions, if you want to take medical deductions, it's way, way, way higher. I'm wondering why, in order to take medical deductions for out-of-pocket costs spent on medical care, it's so much higher.
They did that strictly to bring in more revenue. So it used to be that you could write off medical expenses if they were 2% of your income, and even that's pretty high. You know, that's $1,000 a year for an average family. And they lost so much money due to that deduction that they've now raised it to 7.5%. So very few Americans ever get the deduction for medical expenses. Is there a logical argument to this? The logical argument is we needed more money and this was a place to get it. That's mm-hmm. that's why they did it that way. The charitable deduction, you don't need 2% of your income. You can get a charitable deduction if you can establish, you know, if you did it by check or credit card, anybody can take the deduction. But most people in America, two-thirds of all taxpayers take the standard deduction, so they don't really write off their charitable contributions. The people who really make out on the charitable deduction are very rich people who give works of art to museums. This is a huge... and what you do is you give a painting to a museum and then you hire an appraiser and she says, oh, it was worth $5 million. Because, of course, the taxpayer wants the higher number to get the bigger write-off. There's so many scams around this. They have something called partial giving. Get this. You give the painting to the museum for 3 months, maybe while you're in your summer home in France, and then you come home and put it back in your living room. You get a write-off for those 3 months. So it's really abused.
How do you deal with this argument that we should get tax cuts so people can make their own decisions in terms of where they give their money? I mean, here in the Bay Area, there's so much wealth. And now we have, you know, the Tech A company name on the hospital, a Tech B company name on the school. And so that's what we're seeing more and more of.
Yes.
What is your argument?
I think we should not give any tax deduction for charitable contributions. I don't think it's necessary. Many countries, as I say in my book, have gotten rid of the charitable deduction. And guess what? There's a standard pattern. Maybe for 1 year or 2 years, there's a small drop in contributions. And after 3 years, they start going up again. And you know why? Because people give money because they want to help. They want to give money to help others. They don't do it for the tax deduction. And once people realize there's not a tax deduction, they keep giving. And, you know, those corporations that give a company hall at the library or something, they do it first because they want to help their community and second because they want the PR. And I think if you said to a company, we'll either put your name on the new library or we'll give you a tax deduction, they take the name every time. So we don't need a tax deduction for charity to encourage people to give charity. I think it cheapens the charitable impulse to say I would only give to my church if you give me a tax break for it. I'd give to them anyway.
We have a question about this. Let's go to Mary in San Francisco. Hi, Mary.
Hi. I work for a nonprofit. I also work for a tax preparer, so I think I have a couple of perspectives on this. But I've heard Mr. Reed mention that it would take 3 years for the charitable deductions or charitable contributions to come back online after the deduction might be eliminated. But the fact is that most charities don't have that ramp. Most charities would go out of business within a year, and I just would like to, you know, have a comment on that.
Yeah, I hear that objection. In the first place, I don't think your contributions would fall to zero. They might fall slightly. We have good experimentation on this in the 1980s. So in 1980, the top income tax rate in America was 70%. So if some rich guy gave $1,000 to your charity, he got a $700 write-off. We reduced the top rate to 28%, and that sharply reduced the value of the charitable deduction. And the Council on Foundations opposed that cut on the grounds that people would give less money. And guess what? It didn't happen. There was 1 year, 1987, when contributions dipped a little. And by the second year, 1988, they were going up again. And here's why. If you lower the rate, people have higher take-home pay, and then they have more money they can give to charities. So I think history shows that this is not a serious loss to charities. And we can get a lower rate so people have more money left over after they pay tax, and then they want to give it to people. They want to help others.
Thank you for calling, Mary. Let's go to Phil in New Mexico. Hi, Phil.
Hi, Roseanne. This is a question that's more about TR's last book, which was on comparative health policies of different countries. And ever since the Obamacare debates, I've been recommending that book to people I talk to in terms of saying, you know, we can learn so much about how other countries have done it. Please read this book.
You're my guy, Phil. Thank you.
Your book was just fantastic. And my question for you is, we're looking at the mess that health care in this country still is, how would you recommend that we get to universal coverage, if not actual single payer? Because that was one of the things I learned in your book, that there were other countries, that the two things are different, that you can get to
That's
universal
right.
coverage with not necessarily a single-payer solution a la Canada. That would be my preference. But as I said, I learned so much from your book. And so anyway, if you were advising the Democrats, and let's just, you know, suppose for a miracle happened and the Republicans were willing to listen to you, what would you recommend building on Obamacare, modifying Obamacare, whatever, to get us to universal coverage?
Thanks, Phil. Yeah. In my book, The Healing of America, I point out that all the other rich democracies provide health care for everybody. They think it's a moral imperative. But they don't all do it through a government-run single-payer scheme. Germany has 220 different private insurers. Japan has 3,000 different insurance plans. They cover everybody and spend a lot less than we do. So there are a lot of routes to this destination. And I thought for a while we would adopt the German plan because we have powerful insurance companies that fight change. I don't think that'll work now. I don't think the insurance companies will ever come up with a plan that's efficient and covers everybody. They don't want to. So I now believe that the way to get there is Medicare Part E, which is called Medicare for Everybody. That's how we're definitely going to get there. How we get there, I thought we might get there state by state. California is close to setting up a state-run universal plan. New York is even closer. Oregon's going to put it on the ballot next year. We tried in Colorado and failed, but we're going to try again. So, you know, state by state, that's how we got women's suffrage. That's how we got interracial marriage, minimum wage laws, marijuana. That's how we're going to get to universal coverage. The United States ought to do this. We ought to provide health care for everybody. How hard can it be? And we will do it.
To that question, we have a comment from Anand, who says we are brainwashed, thinking taxes are bad. We do not mind paying high insurance premiums, though. At one of the town halls, Bernie Sanders was asked about his proposal to increase taxes to support universal health care. And he said, wouldn't it be better to pay about $500 more per year rather than paying thousands to insurance companies? But somehow it didn't catch up and got lost in the campaign.
No, I think he's exactly right. And one of the problems with our private insurance system is those companies are the least efficient payers in the world. They take 20 cents of every premium dollar goes to paperwork and salaries and advertising. It doesn't go to medical expenses. Doesn't have to be that way. Medicare is a government-run program run by government bureaucrats. Administrative costs of 2.8%, about one-tenth of what the private insurers charge. So right there in a $3 trillion industry, healthcare, if you saved 18%, right there, there's a huge saving for everybody. You'd get better coverage for less money if we did it that way. And eventually, Americans will figure that out. And, you know, the guy that I think might figure that out is a businessman named Donald Trump. So when Donald Trump was a candidate, he said, I'm going to provide health care for everybody. You'll be able to choose your doctor, which, of course, you can't do with the narrow networks and insurance companies, and it's going to cost less. Did he mean it? Well, if he meant it, there's a way to get there, and that is Medicare. It's a very efficient system. It's very popular with those who have it, and it's low cost. And he's a businessman. I think eventually he'll get there. Now, can Donald Trump give us Medicare for all? Here's my answer. Nixon went to China. Clinton took on welfare. Maybe Trump can take on health care.
Well, next Thursday, we're going to have Elizabeth Rosenthal join us, who is a former doctor who became a journalist, to talk about health care fees and why things are so expensive. We have an email from Catherine who says, I do not mind paying taxes. I do mind not getting benefits. Good roads, schools, family health care, different forms of counseling. Like Great Britain, France, and other civilized countries, the money is there, but 60% or so is spent on military funding that goes to other countries.
Well, she's right. We spend a lot of our tax revenue on the military, more than the next 11 countries combined. But, you know, that's democracy. Americans have voted for that. People who run for cutting the military budget don't win. And Trump won the election saying he was going to double or greatly increase military spending. That's what the American people have voted for. And yes, it's true. We do defend the rest of the world. I don't know that I would do that. I mean, we spend $600 billion a year on the military. And when's the last time we won a war? You got to go back to 1991. So I think you might want to rethink that. I could see the argument. But, you know, it's democracy at work. Americans want to spend this money on the military.
And half the country doesn't vote.
Well, yeah, that's true, too. But that's their fault. I mean, in most places they could vote. They just don't. So,
what about just the feeling overall of paying taxes? Because you point out in your book that paying taxes promotes citizenship and accountability and better government because people are more invested in their country and they want to know how their tax dollars are spent. At this point, because there's so much money in politics and so many people believe that the system is corrupt, and it is in so many ways, a lot of people don't want to pay more taxes because they don't like how the money is being spent. They don't like the bureaucracies that are in place. I mean, how do you tackle that?
No, we absolutely see that. When there are gimmicks and giveaways and loopholes for rich people, then people in an ordinary income don't want to pay either. Why should I get stuck when Joe Moneybags over here isn't paying? And so a fairer system, the kind of changes I'm pushing for in this book, A Fine Mess, would, A, make rich people pay their tax, and then the rest of us would say, yeah, well, I like schools, I like hospitals, I like bridges and parks, and they're more inclined to pay, too. You know, we rely on voluntary compliance. We don't send a tax collector to your house to take the money. You have to fill out the return and send in the check. And compliance rates go way up when people feel, gee, this system is fair.
What are some of the major changes you would make to the tax code?
Well, first of all, I'd make it much easier to file. It's ridiculous that we have to spend hours. In April, we ought to be out playing golf, going to the kids' soccer game, having a picnic. It could be, as in other countries, 10 minutes to pay your tax return and cost nothing. The IRS could fill out the form, every line, for almost every American family. I don't know if you've ever gotten this. Every year, I get a letter from the IRS. It's called a CP2000 notice. They send out tens of millions of them. This is the one that says, on line 48Q, you entered $4,218, but it should have been $4,643. And I get that letter, and I think, well, then why did I spend hours filling in the form if they knew? And the answer is, when members of Congress propose that the IRS do our returns for us, as happens in other countries, H&R Block lobbies against it. Intuit, the maker of TurboTax, lobbies against it. But that's an important change that would make things much simpler for Americans. And then we could go out and spend that money curing, spend that time, you know, looking for a cure for disease or just spending time with our family. I'd make that change.
What else?
I would definitely cut the corporate income tax rate. As I said, at the current high rate, they have an interest in finding ways to deduct the tax. And then I'd cut the individual income tax rates. They range from 7% to about 40%. You could cut them sharply if you get rid of all the deductions and exemptions and credits, like I said, for recycling a farm instrument or planting sugarcane. You get a tax break for that. You get a tax break for buying a hybrid car. Well, fine, that saves gas, right? But there's also a tax break for buying a recreational vehicle. That's a gas guzzler. So get rid of all of them, lower the rates, make the return simpler, and make it faster to pay your tax. I think those changes, which many other countries have done, would make our system much better.
Do you think we will get back to a time like we were in the 1960s when the corporate tax brought in 33% of tax revenues and today it's just less than 9%?
Yeah, we should do that. And the way to do that is get rid of those hundreds of exemptions written in there for specific companies. And I think we're going to get there. I think that change is absolutely essential. And I feel pretty good about this. Both Republicans and Democrats realize our current code is a mess. And history shows that every 32 years, we have thrown it out and started over because it gets to be such a monster. The 32 years is up in 2018, and my prediction is history will repeat itself.
In addition to reading your book to learn more about the tax code, since this might come up next year, what's the best way people can use their voices on this issue?
Well, members of Congress are now listening to people. It's harder to ignore because people are angry at Congress. Mm-hmm. So tell your member of Congress, you can, you know, send them an email. They read them. Or go to a town hall and say, why do I have to spend 20 hours filling out tax returns when they know the numbers already? Let them know how you feel, and they respond.
T.R. Reid is author of A Fine Mess, A Global Quest for a Simpler, Fairer, and More Efficient Tax System. He's a commentator for NPR and a former correspondent for The Washington Post. T.R. will be at the Commonwealth Club at noon today in just an hour, 555 Post Street here in San Francisco. T.R., thanks for coming in and thanks for your new book.
I love your show, Rose. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you so much. Coming up, it is our media roundtable. We'll be talking about U.S.-Russia climate change policies and a new SF Public Press report on sea level rise and waterfront development here in San Francisco. Your Call is produced at KALW. Malihe Razazan produced today's show. Stephanie Porcel is our intern. David LaTulipe is our studio engineer. You can email us feedback@yourcallradio.org. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. Thanks for joining us.